We're talking about wildfires in the West and how we think about forest land right here in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. According to the journal Science, it's the West Coast's worst fire season in at least 70 years. Fires in Oregon, Washington, and California have burned millions of acres, killed at least 35 people, destroyed hundreds of structures, and caused extreme air pollution. Are you concerned about the forest fires raging out west? What do you think should be done to help better manage our nation's forest land? Bring your questions, your ideas. We're at 800-642-1234. Robert Simeone has been a forester in northern Wisconsin and South America for 35 years. He co-founded the Forest Stewardship Council. Robert, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, let's first look at the fires that continue to burn out west. Five of California's worst fires have happened in the past 4 years. Why does it seem these fires are getting worse?
There's a multitude of reasons. Probably the greatest is climate change. Fire season has extended now into, you know, several weeks beyond what they used to be. And it's because the climate out west has become drier and the winds have become much more abundant. And the other issue you have is you have a very mature forest in the landscape and a very contiguous forest with very low roaded areas. And so fire can get away and just is wild. I mean, just this year, or just in the last 10 years, an area the size of the state of Oregon has burned, and tens of thousands of homes have burned. So this is going to continue. This is not something that is just this year. The prediction is that this will actually increase over time.
Well, you mentioned Oregon. The amount of timber harvested from federal lands in Oregon has plummeted from 4 billion board feet in 1990 to 486 million last year. What do you see there in terms of managing federal lands and harvesting?
Yeah, I think, you know, mechanical harvests are definitely a big part of reducing the amount of fire risk there is in the areas. And, you know, thinning forest mechanically is a very, very big part. But you also have to consider the history of fire across all the world, really. I mean, fire is universal everywhere in the world. Even the wettest areas of the Amazon burn. And you also have to consider the role that indigenous or aboriginal people played in managing fire on this landscape. Evidence was that human settlements in North and South America were 10 to 20,000 years ago first came into North America, South America. But now there's evidence that shows that human settlements occurred 40,000 or plus years ago. So there's a long history of indigenous presence on the landscape, and indigenous people learned many, many years ago, a long time ago, how to manage forest or how to manage fire and use fire. And since indigenous people have been removed from the landscape and these management systems have been removed from the landscape, the forest has matured and become more dense. We have outbreaks of all kinds of epidemics of disease and insects, which exacerbates the amount of fuel of dead and down timber on the ground. So yes, mechanical things and forest industries play a big role in reducing some of this risk, but it's just one piece of the puzzle.
We're talking with Robert Simeone, who's a forester who has worked with indigenous communities in Wisconsin, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador. We're learning about the forest fires out west and what to do in terms of managing natural resources. Have you seen a forest fire? Can you tell us what it was like? How did it change your perspective on forest management? Join in at 800-642-1234. Robert, you look at Native American forestry management practices. What do you, and certainly your work in multiple countries in South America, How does that inform how you see fire in forests and in the management of these forests?
Yeah, I think we have a lot to learn from the First Nations that have occupied this landscape for a long period. I mean, they created, actually, instead of a contiguous forest, it was a patchwork of forest. It was a mosaic of grasslands, meadows, and open canopy forests. And the fire that they would set, basically, they would fell trees and create garden plots, and on a small scale, though across the landscape, it was very extensive. And the fire that they used was frequent and low-intensity fires. So this actually rejuvenated the landscape. It rejuvenated the forest, created all kinds of... The reason they did this is because it recycled potash and charcoal into the soils. It stimulated a lot of growth of beneficial plants, native plants, like bunch grasses and forbs and bulbs, useful plants like medicinal and utility plants, right? It also increased the amount of browse for the animals that they hunted, like deer and elk and bison. So there was this, they controlled and managed the landscape to a large degree. The forest in the 1830s, when white settlers or European settlers came into Wisconsin, the perception was that Wisconsin was, the northern forest in particular, was just a wilderness, a virgin forest. And that is far from the truth, because we already had 200 to 300 years of indigenous people being removed from the landscape. The pre-settlement, or let's say pre-Columbian population in North South America, is estimated to be between 90 and 100 million people between the two continents of original people. But from the 1515 to about 1560, there were waves of pandemics that moved through because of the explorers that came into the region, brought European diseases like smallpox and measles, influenza, all these types of, and there was literally 5 or 6 waves of pandemics that went through these communities that eliminated about 90% or more of the indigenous people that were in North and South America at that time. So the landscape that we had here in North America or in Wisconsin was really abandoned land by these indigenous communities for the most part. So we then had, the forest had 200-300 years of undisturbed growth, and we had this massive forest. And then, of course,
What were the dominant trees in Wisconsin when these settlers arrived?
We have a very diverse landscape, a diverse forest landscape, and we have also very fragmented ownership today. But even back in pre-settlement time, the forest was very diverse. We have a range of soil types based on what the glaciers left us. So we go from very sandy alluvial sand soils to heavier moraine-type soils. And in the alluvial soils, which were deposited by as the glaciers were receding, they left through the movement of water off the glaciers, sand or these alluvial fans. And on those types of forests or soils, we had pine forests established. In the moraine areas, which are heavier soils, loamier soils, they're not as dry as the pines or the sandy soils. They're more mesic or more wet, and we had hardwood forests develop on there. So it was a very diverse, from very pure stands of pine to in the hardwoods, actually the most abundant tree people don't realize. If you go up the Sylvania Wilderness in the Upper Peninsula, you'll see the most abundant tree on those hardwood sites was eastern hemlock, actually.
We have to stop there with Robert Simeone. Back in a moment on the Ideas
Good
Network.
Morning. Let's take a look at the weather on this Thursday. There's a chance of showers across the state, especially this morning. Thunderstorms are possible this afternoon in the south. Generally, mostly cloudy skies. And temperatures ranging from the mid-40s to the upper 50s. Breezy day with wind gusts. And tonight, widespread frost across the state carrying into the morning. Partly cloudy skies, calm winds, and lows around 30 degrees. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up this afternoon on Central Time, environmental and safety advocate Erin Brockovich joins the show to talk about her new book on water quality. Find out why she says Superman's not coming to protect our water. That's today at 3 on Central Time.
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
Support also comes from Overture Center for the Arts, thanking the Madison community for its support. Details on Overture's efforts to heal the community through art and a list of performances for 2021 are at overture.org.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the devastating wildfires out west and how that should inform how we think about managing timberland here in Wisconsin. We're getting the history. It's this hour's conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Numbers from the National Interagency Fire Center, 87 large wildland fires have burned over 4.7 million acres in California, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. How should these wildfires be controlled? Can you prevent them from happening at all? If you are from a tribal community, how do you approach timberland management practices? Join in any point here, 800-642-1234. We have longtime professional forester Robert Simeone, who is our guide and specializing in South American timber species. So, Robert, how did forest management change after European settlers took over the land and found, as you were saying, this diverse landscape of trees?
Well, in case of Wisconsin, if you're a resident of Wisconsin, you probably know about the Peshtigo fire, which occurred on the exact same day as the Great Chicago fire. Great Chicago fire, I think some 50 people were killed. Burned almost the entire city. At that time, it was all wooden buildings. But the Peshtigo fire burned over 1 million acres and killed 1,500 or more people. They really don't even know how many people occupied at that time. So they really don't have a good estimate of how many people actually died in that fire. So since that time, since the 1870s, we have moved across North America. There's been a big movement towards fire suppression. And this has had a big impact in terms of what's happening, because we no longer, instead of the low, you know, wildfire in the past was frequent, low intensity, as we mentioned, but now we have catastrophic fire because the amount of fuel that has been built up over this history, 150 years of fire suppression. So this is a big part of why we today have a catastrophic fire occurring. We've been fortunate in Wisconsin because climate change is, at least at the moment, we have our climate here in Wisconsin is wet compared to what it is out west. But this can change because Wisconsin has a history of entering into periods of drought that can last a decade or more. And if that was to occur, we would see a lot more wildfire in Wisconsin.
It could change very drastically our circumstances. We're talking with Robert Simeone, who has been a forester in northern Wisconsin and South America for decades. We're discussing the fires out west and the native history of managing timberland, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Gail now, joining us from Black River Falls. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, I have not heard your conversation this morning. A friend just called me up and said, hey, they're talking about, you know, California. And I literally just 2 weeks ago moved from California. And one of the things that my friend and I had discussed in the past was kind of a bit of a misconception about California and some of these fires. And that is that a lot of them, for example, for the city of Paradise or town of Paradise that got wiped out, those are all savanna fires. When we talk about forests in a lot of California. They're really not forests like Wisconsin. Yes, we do have ones like Wisconsin, but there's a huge areas, thousands of acres of grasslands and savannas with groups of oaks in them. So, and they're called oak forests, but they're not forests in a traditional sense. And so there's no real way to manage them like, you know, you would a typical timber forest. And the other thing is I lived up there as a child. I was raised in that Northern California or Central Northern California area. But I also lived for 20 years, just moved from Southern California. And a lot of the foothills of Southern California that tend to be a lot of these things that burn, for example, Malibu and all those types of areas, are all mesquite forests. They're brushland, and they're filled with things that mesquite and greasewood and manzanita, and these things are all high oil that dry out and they burn very rapidly and, you know, are difficult to control. So it's not, you know, they make it sound like it's,
you can't make a blanket statement on forests. Gail, thank you. Robert, you know, Gail is making this distinction between grasslands and timber forests, and there's much more nuance here.
Absolutely. And she's correct in that most of the fires that have been occurring in California in particular are not forests per se, but are, like she's saying, these shrublands or chaparral. But that also is the fact that those areas are contiguous and is also the fact that fire has been eliminated off the landscape. That's not the natural landscape. The natural landscape is a patchwork of open meadows and mesquite and chaparral. It's just that we've suppressed fire. So these areas have filled in with a lot of these resin trees and shrubs, which has created these situations. So fire suppression is really has played a big role in the landscape we see today.
Gail, thanks for the call and welcome to the Wisconsin, by the way, Gail. Let's bring in Tim now, joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As a carpenter, I think we need to do a little more harvesting. The price of lumber has gotten high. You mentioned the numbers of how much the harvest has been reduced in places like Oregon. Before we see the trees go up into smoke, I'd love to see some management of the forest so we can start bringing prices down where it's more manageable for people.
Tim, thank you. A carpenter there, Robert, saying, you know, can we bring more harvesting? And that could impact the economy for wood.
I totally agree. 40 years ago, we had a very integrated forest industry in Wisconsin. Today, it's much less. A lot of those mills and flooring mills and veneer mills and have closed down, carpentry shops. Part of it is also, we've also lost a lot of our pulp and paper industry, moved offshore. And that is a problem because if we lose our pulp market, now we don't have an economic incentive to thin our forest because we don't have any market for that thin timber. But the tendency has been for 40 years at least, we've pushed the forest into more, let's say, pioneer stages, aspen and birch and other short-lived trees because they were a source of fiber for pulp and paper, instead of letting, in a lot of cases, the hardwoods come back, and we could manage by thinning those hardwoods. Those are high-value woods, and unfortunately, we've lost a lot of our industry that would take advantage of those.
Have a hole in the supply chain there.
Huge, yeah. It hasn't happened overnight. It's has been a trend, we have the valuable resource. If you look around, what's going in northern Wisconsin, we are living within a forest landscape, and that's another issue. People, the landscape has become more fragmented, and the ownerships have become smaller, and people are moving their homes into the forest interface. Which, look at Paradise, California. You have a situation where it was only one escape route, and there was a very dangerous situation, and the whole town was consumed. We have actually in Wisconsin and in the Upper Peninsula and Upper Peninsula of Michigan similar situations where we have whole communities that have been built within the forest landscape. And if this is a time, because we're in this wetter period, for property owners in Wisconsin to look around their home and begin to plan for fire mitigation. If they live in within the forest interface, they need to create what's called a defensible space around their homes, particularly if you have pines. Jack pine, for example, is a native species that's short-lived and regenerates by fire. So fire will come in, and you need to plan for that. So access, things like an escape route, all these things need to be considered. But if you have jack pine or balsam fir within close proximity of your home, you should remove those within 100, 150 feet from your home.
So you're saying making a perimeter so the fire can't jump onto your home.
Right, because you should assume that fire will occur at some point. It's universal. If you walk around in the forest, you will see signs of wildfire that are historic. Charcoal doesn't disappear. It stays for centuries. So you can, if you just walk in the forest, you can see signs of wildfire in the past. So fire will reoccur. So we just need to plan for it and expect that this will happen.
Yeah, it's not if, but when. Wisconsin forester Robert Simeone is our guide to how we can improve our management of forests as we look at the devastating forest fires that have ravaged the Western U.S. Have you seen a forest fire? What is it like? What questions do you have about sustainably managing forest land here in Wisconsin? What standards would you like the DNR to uphold and enforce? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Robert Simeone right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about forest fires, forest management practices, this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our country has more than 750 million acres of forest land. More than half of that land is owned by private landowners or timber companies like your Weyerhaeusers, Georgia-Pacific. That's from the National Agricultural Law Center. We're watching as millions of acres burn out west. Foresters, we want to hear from you especially. How have you seen management practices evolve through your career? What's your take on regenerating Wisconsin's forests? What challenges do you face? It's 800-642-1234. Wisconsin-based forester Robert Simeone is our guide. He co-founded the Forest Stewardship Council. That's an organization that promotes responsible management of the world's forests. Let's take another call now. Jeff is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. What point would you like to add? What's your question?
So I know that there has been a resurgence in doing prescribed burns and whatnot, but we're still making sure that catastrophic fires don't happen. I was just curious, have we lost certain landscapes by suppressing the catastrophic fires, such as like oak savanna or something like that?
How has fire changed the landscape, Robert?
Yeah, the fire suppression has had a dramatic change on the landscape. And, in Wisconsin, out west, they have a fire season that usually goes throughout the summer. In Wisconsin, it's different for us here. We have two fire seasons, one in the spring and one in the fall. In the spring, once the snows go away, we have this situation where we have a lot of, dry leaves and things on the ground, and until the forest greens up around the 15th of May, there is a high risk of fire. And a lot of times we have high winds in early April and May, which can exacerbate that situation. So that's a pretty significant fire risk time in Wisconsin. We also have one in the fall. Once the leaves drop off the trees and dry up in the forest, and if we don't get rains, and until those first snows come, that's also a very dangerous time in Wisconsin. So, as the caller suggests, prescribed burning is another part of the equation to reduce fire risk. And if it's well timed in those periods when we have low risk of fire, it can be very, very effective. Also, managing, letting wildfire burn and kind of hurting wildfire, particularly out west, where you can just let wildfire burn, is another option besides combining this with, you know, mechanical timber harvesting and things. So there's much we can do, but most important is that we need to make people aware of the danger. And also, as a society, we need to take a look at how we are allowing people to settle into this forest interface and try to minimize that as much as possible. It's just like in the floodplains. You know, people in towns should not be allowed to build within the floodplains. If you build a levee, you're just pushing the problem downstream. Rivers ought to run wild, and in the spring they should be able to overflood their banks without destroying homes and endangering people.
I thought that control. Jeff, thanks. You know, along those lines, Nancy from Milwaukee called in to tell us that these fires are related to land being overdeveloped, that Nancy says there's just too much building and growth. What can you say there to Nancy's point?
I totally agree. I mean, it's also the fact that we have such a fragmented ownership, increasingly fragmented ownership in the North Forest, makes it very difficult to manage these stands. Because, you know, a lot of property owners, they'll buy a 40 or a 10-acre piece, and they won't cut any trees, or they won't enter into some type of forest plan. And so you just have, I mean, there's nothing wrong with old-growth forest. I'm not speaking against anything like that. We only have a few remnant areas that are considered old-growth forest. But the, you know, in terms of fire mitigation, I think people just on an individual basis, they buy a piece of property that has forest. They just need to be aware of what type of trees they are, what type of forest it is, and minimize by creating defensible spaces and things around their homes.
I want to ask you, Robert, about clear-cutting forest land, because when I saw my first clear-cut, I was out reporting trip. Lived in Louisiana for a number of years in the piney woods of North Louisiana, so very much forest land. And I knew this forest land well by sight, and you know, and it was gone. And I asked the person I was interviewing, by the way, there was used to be a forest across the road from you just a couple weeks ago. It's completely gone. And he said, yeah, the timber company liquidated that last week. And I asked, you know, what's behind that? Why would they do that? And said, you know, man, that's just a business decision. And apparently, too, the timber company knew that the people across the road, that organization next to that former forest land, wouldn't be happy with the clear cut. So they gave them access to a really important well that they had wanted for a long time. So there was like this goodwill exchange of natural resources. You know, what do you make of clear cutting? What are the business decisions that go into it?
Well, it is definitely a controversial issue because, you know, industrial forest management has become kind of the standard. The forest you're speaking about down in Louisiana were probably southern pine. And those forests, again, would have naturally been open forest. Or fire would have been frequent and low intensity. And you would have had a diversity of species. Many of those areas have been replaced by plantations of single species, single even aged stands, and that reduces your options in terms of regenerating that forest. So industrial forestry generally thinks of the forest as a crop, and it would be regenerated every, you know, 50 to 80 years or so, or even shorter rotations than that. So, yeah, there is an industrial mindset, no question about it. We're fortunate here in Wisconsin to have much more diversity in terms of our forests, but there clear cutting is a common practice. In some cases, it's justified just because you have whole stands of pure stands of jack pine, for example, in the town of Conover, for example, up here in the north. That entire town is surrounded, just like Boulder Junction was, with jack pine. And again, these are pioneer trees. The jack pine only lives to be, you know, 50 or 60 years old, and then it dies. It's not like a white pine or a red pine. And so these trees are very resinous and are dangerous. So, and it's a valuable commodity. It's a wood that can go into pulp and paper. It's a very valuable tree in that sense. So a lot of the Vilas County Forests, for example, are managed on even age or clear-cut type management systems, mainly because of the forest and the soils that they have available to them. So it's diverse. You have some sandy sites where you have pure stands of pine that unfortunately would be rotated through clear cutting, hopefully not on a large scale, meaning less than 40 acres at a time, not these extensive clear cuts that we have seen occur.
We're talking about forest growth and regeneration as wildfires continue out west. Robert Simeone is our guide. He's been a forester in northern Wisconsin and South America for decades. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mark now, joining us from Bellevue. Hi, Mark. What would you like to add?
Yes. Good morning, Kate. Good morning. I grew up in Australia. I observed forest fires since my childhood, and they're quite devastating. The thing that we learned in our environment there was that the things that you're talking about clearing around your house are incredibly important, but also the homeowner, if they have to make a decision as to whether they're going to stay or go, and if they're going to stay, they have to be absolutely prepared. Firefighting equipment, etc. If you haven't got that preparation, then go away, protect your life, and just let the buildings burn. It's a bit, as you say, it's a bit like floods. We wouldn't really want to put people in danger. So be prepared, but make the decision the right way.
Mark, thank you for adding that. Robert, what are those precautions that property owners, I mean, you mentioned making the perimeter around the home, but what about escape routes?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole series of things that a landowner can do to protect themselves, prepare for fire season. And this is the time, because we're in this wetter period, it's time for people to look at potential or fire mitigation procedures they can practice around their property. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has a whole program to assist landowners on an individual basis to assess fire risk on their properties and implement mitigation. A lot of it is just clearing combustible material around your property, right? Again, removing certain species of trees in particular within 150 to 200 feet from your buildings can make all the difference of your home surviving or not. The caller mentioned Australia. They've this past year, if you'll remember, they had some of the most incredible catastrophic fires ever in the history of that country. And this is global. This is not something, I mean, look what's happening in the Amazon. Of course, a lot of that is because of clearings of agriculture and others. But fire is universal. It will always be here. It will always occur. There's nothing we can do to eliminate it. And we shouldn't eliminate it. All we need to learn to manage it.
Robert Simeone is a forester in Wisconsin, and we're talking about forests and their future. Has your life been altered by a forest fire? Have you visited the Amazon rainforest? What can you tell us about the lungs of the planet? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about forest management and how people can reduce the risk of catastrophic fires. Our guide is Wisconsin forester Robert Simeone, and his work with indigenous communities in Bolivia, in Peru, Ecuador, it led him to become one of the founders of the Forest Stewardship Council, and he's our guide. Let's bring in Louise joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Louise. What would you like to add?
Oh, good morning. I would wonder if your guest would address the problem of invasive species in our forests, such as honeysuckle bush, autumn olive, Japanese barberry, birdsfoot trefoil. There are so many invasive species that the forest floor is damp, and a lot of it won't even burn. We used to own a hobby farm, and we had lots of Japanese barberry, all of these things, and it would be so damp it wouldn't burn. So how about hiring people and training them to remove invasive species? And also, I have been told that would reduce the deer ticks substantially, so it would help with the Lyme disease problems and so on.
Louise, thank you so much. Robert, what about these non-native trees and their impact?
Yeah, it's a big problem. We have buckthorn, garlic mustard. There's so many invasives that have come into the state. And actually, things like buckthorn do increase the risk of fire, wildfire, because it provides, instead of just becoming a ground fire, it can actually have a ladder effect into the canopy of the forest. So prescribed burning, again, would be one option, but it is a big, big issue. Again, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources could help assess individual landowners and make recommendations in terms of how they might eliminate these species, or just in the case of fire, mitigate or reduce the risk.
Well, I looked up the beautiful Scots pine in my front yard is invasive. I couldn't even believe that some of these trees that even in our own backyards are invasive.
Right. Well, that's unfortunately, that's these species that have come in many cases are now part of the natural landscape and will probably always be here. So we just need to learn to live with them and manage it so we don't that we don't increase these issues of fire danger. But yeah, a lot of earthworms are another huge problem we're having. 10 years ago, people weren't even aware that earthworms were not native, and they're invasive into the forest. They consume the humus, dries out the forest, increases the risk of wildfire because the herbaceous layer that used to exist is going away. So when people fish, please do not dump your earthworms into the forest. When you're done fishing, just throw them back into the lake. Throw them into the lake and the fish will consume them. But anyway, that is an issue. Yeah. There's so many invasives that have come, diseases and insects that have come in, and vegetation that has come into the state.
We're talking with Robert Simeone, a forester in Wisconsin. Let's bring in Joan now from Keewaskum. Hi, Joan. What would you like to add? Hi.
I would like to know, I've lived in a lot of areas where there's forests, and there's so much dead wood in these woods. Why don't they, put a sign out there for people to come and take it? Because there's so many people that burn wood.
Joan, thank you. And piggybacking off that, President Trump has criticized California for failing to manage its forests properly, saying the state needs to clean your floors, meaning there's too much debris on the ground that is fueling fires. Robert?
Again, it depends on the type of forest we're talking about, because forest ecologists will refer to some of that material as fallen woody debris, which play an important ecological role for supporting salamanders and other invertebrates and mycorrhizae in the soil. So they also play a very important ecological role. At the same time, I agree that particularly following any type of timber harvest, there's a lot of material, the slash that follows these operations, that could be harvested by people for firewood and other things. And those, yes, that should be. Understand that in Wisconsin, 70% of the ownership is private, where out west, it's just the inverse. Only 30% of the ownership out west is private. So here we have, it's much more difficult because we have so many different types of ownerships and different ideas about how the land should be managed. It's harder to allow, on state land, yes, we can allow these types of, you know, people to come in and maybe cut the tops and reduce the amount of slash and thereby, you know, eliminating or mitigating fire, wildfire.
Let's bring in Dave now in Oshkosh. Hi there, Dave.
Hi. I work with my dad. I'm 65, but I grew up in Upper Michigan, and my dad was a logger, and my brothers that incentivized us to go to school, by the way. It was a lot of hard work, but my dad, we didn't even realize at the time, but he was a real environmentalist before the word was even coined, I guess, but he would go in and would call the conservation or DNR at the time, would come in and mark certain diseased trees in certain parts of Upper Michigan, and we would cut, that's what we would cut, and then we would also do clear cutting, but then planting. But forest needs to be managed, and I've seen so many people that buy acreage, like your guest was saying, and then they say, oh, well, I'm going to keep this pristine and natural. Well, pristine and natural, everything needs to be managed. And that's one thing I learned from my dad when we would log, and we even cut everything because he heated the house with wood. We would cut tops, and but I took my wife recently through some of the forest we logged off, and she couldn't get over it. Beautiful oaks growing. I was pointing out where our skid trails were. They made natural fire lanes. Upper Michigan really has very few problems with fires in the woods anymore. And a lot of loggers, a lot of my dad's friends are still loggers, and they're more, loggers get a bad rap, but I mean, they're more land managers than they are anything right now, because they go in with certain equipment and select cut and manage the forest. But people got to understand that forests need to be managed, especially.
And I want to jump in here, Dave, and allow Robert to respond to the work that loggers do, and specifically Dave's experiences in Upper Michigan.
I agree 100%. I mean, your father worked during a period when we had a very integrated forest industry up here, and was, you know, his work was perceived very differently than it is today. Yeah, the loggers are the quiet champions out there. They're a very important link in supply chain in the forest industry. If we lose the loggers, now we have lost a very important part of how we can manage these forests. And the loggers I work with are, you know, aging demographic. These guys are in their 60s and 70s or even older, and young people just don't want to go into the profession. It's risky. It's hard work. And
I'm sure, is very expensive.
Oh, huge. Well, you know, there's different types of operations. There's operations that are set up for clear cutting, and that's a whole different type of machine. For thinning hardwoods, for example, you need smaller machineries, and it takes a huge amount of skill to go through the forest, and we only cut during the winter months for the most part when the ground is frozen, so we have minimum impact on the ground. But in these type of select cuts, when we're trying to leave the very best trees and remove the diseased trees and whatever, it requires a huge amount of skill. These loggers are highly skilled, and how they work in the forest without having any impact on the residual trees.
Well, Robert, we only have a couple seconds left, but anything to give us hope for how forest health is managed?
Yeah, I think just people need to educate themselves and understand that we're fortunate in Wisconsin to have a very diverse forest, and they just need to understand, because we have 70% of our landscape is privately owned, people need to take a good look at the land that they do own and think about fire. And they also need to think about how to best manage that fire mm-hmm. to mitigate forest. And you can get valuable forest products off your property without compromising the aesthetic or the the effect of on the natural environment.
Robert, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thanks for your time too.
Robert Simeone, forester in northern Wisconsin for decades. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.